You know the expression, don't shoot the messenger? Well, meet the messenger. His name is Kevin Seitz. He has traveled the world to the global hotspots, to the disaster areas, to the war zones, and has written about his travels in a book called In the Hot Zone, One Man, One Year, 20 Wars. I have seen this man's work both online and on TV for several years, and I'm very happy to welcome him to KMOX this afternoon. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me on today.
My pleasure. When I say don't shoot the messenger and that you're the messenger that people wanted to shoot, I'm referring in particular to that incident in Fallujah in 2004 that brought your name to the blogosphere big time.
Right. It was one of the most disturbing moments of my career and perhaps my life. But I was embedded with the U.S. Marines just prior to the Battle of Fallujah in November 2004. And, of course, went in with them during that battle. And I ended up videotaping a U.S. Marine really executing an unarmed insurgent within a Fallujah mosque. That videotape certainly became a flashpoint, I think, for a lot of controversy, you know, both over the war, over the role of journalists within war, and, you know, really over the war itself. And I think part of the problems with that particular story is that we censored ourselves. I worked for NBC at the time as a freelance correspondent, and we didn't show the whole videotape. And in not doing that, we lost some of the context. Some people didn't know what was happening there. You know, was the Marine acting in self-defense? Was this man moving? Was the body booby-trapped? You know, a lot of valid questions that the videotape itself probably could have answered. And so what happened, Paul, is that the way I was able to correct that report, some of the confusion that it created, was to use my own personal blog. I had a blog at the time, and I wrote a 2,500-word article explaining in much greater detail what was going on and mitigated some of that confusion, mitigated some of the hate mail, although I still get plenty of hate mail. I got about 300 hate mails and death threats for about a year solid.
300 a day, right?
About a day, that's right.
And let's go back to that mosque in Fallujah for just a moment, because you weren't just some reporter who was running around doing whatever you wanted to. You were actually embedded with these Marines, which means you got to know them, right?
Of course. You know, and the thing is, this had been probably my seventh embed. You know, I've done about 12 of them altogether. But I've spent, you know, I have probably more experience than most of the soldiers and Marines that I've been with. I've been covering conflict for 5 years, even prior to starting this project. And so I had seen plenty of battles. I'd seen lots of fighting. And I know what the rules of engagement entail, and I know what the Geneva Convention entails. And this clearly was a violation of the Geneva Convention. Now, listen, I don't have any interest in doing kind of gotcha journalism and trying to catch somebody, you know, trying to perform the duties of their job and so on. But as a journalist, it's also my responsibility to report everything that happens, both good and bad, and to look at the truth of a particular situation. And this particular situation was just not right.
And because you were embedded with them and knew them, were you torn internally between, yeah, I want to tell the story, but, boy, this is a story that if I tell it, I know there's going to be trouble?
Well, yeah, and it wasn't so much a feeling that it was about betraying the people that I'm with. You know, my loyalty is to the truth. That's got to be the first thing. I certainly liked these guys. I felt, you know, somewhat like a big brother to them. I let them use my sat phone to call their girlfriends and their wives. And I know that the majority of the people that I've been embedded with have always been, you know, either good soldiers or good Marines. You know, and there's occasions where there are moral dilemmas that happen within the course of conflict. And sometimes they make the right decision, sometimes they make the wrong decision, but sometimes there are decisions that are just clearly wrong. And, you know, this is one of those cases. My dilemma was really about the difficulty in fulfilling both of my responsibilities as a journalist. Number one, seek and report the truth. But a lot of people don't realize, as a journalist, we're also compelled to minimize the harm. And I thought potentially that piece of videotape could create more bloodshed.
Now, what do you mean by that? When you say harm, what harm and bloodshed could have come from showing this?
A couple of things I thought could have resulted. You know, number one, that insurgents would refuse to surrender, thinking that they might be executed. Or the reverse could happen as well, that, you know, this information could get out there and U.S. Marines and soldiers would be routinely executed if they were captured. The same thing could happen to them. Or that there could be reprisal killings because of the shooting in the mosque. You know, I explained it to a lot of people. I said, try to imagine the passions that that this would create if a U.S. Marine had been killed, you know, in a church after he had surrendered and, you know, was wounded, say, perhaps during World War II, you know, in the south of France or something like that. But, you know, there are many circumstances that you just have to look at from a lot of different angles to truly try to understand them. And that was one of my dilemmas. You know, ultimately, I pushed to censor the videotape, to not show the whole thing. And I think that was the wrong decision. I'm as complicit in that as everyone else. And here's the interesting thing part of it, Paul. Not one U.S. station showed the entire video, yet most of the stations in Europe and the Middle East did show it. So it was our military that was involved in this event, yet at the same time, our American public weren't able to see it and make their own conclusions about it. And in that case, we failed them miserably.
And when you say you censored it, the footage that you shot, you actually did two different versions. The one that you talked about being seen in Europe and the Middle East, which had the complete footage, but the one that you put on NBC, and which I guess the rest of the U.S. broadcasters opted to use as well, freeze-framed right at the moment of the Marine pulling the trigger, and we heard the gunshot but didn't see the effect of the gunshot, right?
That's it. And plus, you also didn't see what the environment was like before that Marine walked into the mosque itself, and then also what happened afterwards. Now, here's a very fascinating thing that a lot of people don't know about as well. I did a Freedom of Information Act request about this investigation afterwards. There was another insurgent within that mosque. Actually, there were five that were wounded altogether, and that same Marine had shot them a second time. Then shot the insurgent in front of my camera when I came in. But there was another insurgent that was there as well that was only slightly wounded, and he was under a blanket. And when he heard the shots, he pulled the blanket down and raised his hands, you know, basically, don't shoot me. I interviewed that insurgent afterwards, after the Marine fired the shot and then walked out of the mosque. And I tried to talk to him. He only spoke Arabic. I later had the tape translated. But he had been there. He had seen everything that had happened. And I left to report the story. And I left him in that mosque. After I left, he was shot 23 times in the back.
Mm.
And, you know, that's something that is, you know, within the Naval Criminal Investigative Services report that I actually requested when I came back. Now, the idea is not necessarily to lay the blame, you know, at any one person in this incident. It's really to try to look at war in the face. As hard as it is, there are atrocities that are committed on all sides in conflict. And we have to be able to look at that and look at it honestly, as painful as it can be. You know, my parents are both veterans. You know, they serve their country honorably. I think most men and women in uniform do that. And there are cases where you know, there are moral dilemmas where choices are made, and they might not be the wrong choice, but they were made with the right intentions. But there are also cases where people just choose the wrong thing for whatever reason. And I think that we have to consider all of those factors when we look at war and really try to understand it. I think, Paul, the most important thing here is that these men and women come back into our society, and we don't know what they've gone through. You know, for the most part, we give them that kind of empty, you know, thank you for your service, but they know they've done things that they're proud of and things that they're not proud of, and yet they also know that no one understands that except the other soldiers that they were with. If we were doing our job as journalists, more people in society would understand what they're going through, and they would see it honestly, and I think perhaps embrace them and bring them back into society in a more fulfilling way.
Have you had anyone in uniform or anyone in a position of authority come to you and say rationally and calmly, look, we understand what news is, and this was certainly a news story, but because you showed that footage on the air and people got to see that in the Mideast and elsewhere around the world, here are the consequences of that story. Has anyone said that to you?
No, I mean, here's the interesting thing. I think a lot of people implied that, people that were ill-informed, you know, writing to me on the website and saying, you know, this is what you've done. You've raised a certain amount of propaganda. And my counter to that was, you know, that absolutely couldn't be less true. You know, for instance, the U.S. military and the U.S. government did not try to take away that videotape from me. I was able to air that videotape, and it gave credence to the fact that our ideals of press freedom are embedded so deeply that even on the front line, within a very hot battle, I was able to process and air this report, which was potentially very damaging. And yet that says to our enemies and allies alike, this is a country that believes in the freedom of the press. I can't think of another army, you know, that would have allowed me to do the same thing in the same circumstances. And that's one of the cases I'm very proud of. Was justice, you know, completely served in this particular case? You know, probably not. But that's because there are questions of how this happened. You know, was it the Marine that was really responsible, or were the rules of engagement relaxed that allowed him to do this? And by relaxed, I mean relaxed illegally. You know, the Geneva Convention prevents us as a nation, you know, from executing prisoners. You know, those are the laws that we are signatories to and we have to abide by. And, you know, my feeling is that there were several other cases within Fallujah of prisoners being executed. So there may have been an order, you know, at a higher level to possibly relax the rules of engagement.
The book is called In the Hot Zone, One Man, One Year, 20 Wars. With the book, which is a paperback, comes a DVD. On it is a documentary called A World of Conflict. And if you haven't seen it, you can also catch segments of it on the Yahoo page, hotzone.yahoo.com. So are you still producing content solely for Yahoo, Kevin?
I am, but I'm actually doing a different project called People of the Web right now. We're updating the Hot Zone with information that we have from local sources and so on. But for the most part, the new project is about putting a human face on the people of the internet, you know, reaching through the screen and getting past the technology and seeing how people are changing society. And it's POTW.news.yahoo.com if you want to check that out.
Okay. POTW for People of the Web.
Right.
All right. Let's talk about a couple of other things that you've done, like covering the tsunami in Indonesia almost 3 years ago. When things like that happen, is there something in your brain that says, get the suitcase, we're going?
Well, it was a strange situation because we were just talking about the mosque shooting.
Yes.
And I had left Iraq, and I was pretty frazzled at that point, and I knew I needed a vacation. So I was going to meet a few friends of mine in Thailand and go scuba diving, and I went diving there for about a week and a half and then traveled around to different parts of Thailand and Laos and Cambodia. And I was in Cambodia when the tsunami struck. And so I called NBC News, and we had a bit of a strained relationship after the mosque shooting. And I said, you know, do you want me to go and cover it? And I said, this is huge. It's getting bigger by the moment. And initially they said no, and then said, well, yeah, you're right in position. Maybe you better go. They called me back a couple of hours later, but I was already on a plane. I was going there regardless. I knew how big the story was, and I went back to Thailand, and I was covering the tsunami there, and then eventually went with them into Banda Aceh, Indonesia. And the strange thing about it for me, Paul, was that I had there was so much more death associated with the tsunami than I had ever seen in war. I'd certainly seen my share of killing and all the conflict that I covered, but I had never seen that many bodies in so many horrific ways, you know, twisted in trees and cars and, you know, just in the places where they had been, you know, just before the tsunami hit. And yet, strangely enough for me, it was not as disturbing to me as the killing that I had seen in war. And I guess the reason for that was that this was an act of God. This was a natural disaster. And then people were actually unifying, trying to help people in the tsunami. You know, the USS Abraham Lincoln was parked off the coast of Indonesia, you know, making 90,000 gallons of fresh water. And I had never seen people in the military so completely happy as they were at that point, you know, actually providing assistance, you know, not dropping bombs on people, but bringing them fresh water. And, you know, within war, even though the numbers of deaths, you know, were certainly smaller in my experience, it was more difficult to see that kind of man-made conflict, you know, people killing each other.
What was the reaction to the locals there, to the American presence as an assistance you know, in helping out with the people who needed the water, who needed whatever it was they needed? America, like many other countries around the world, served up huge, huge sums of money and huge numbers of people. And, you know, private citizens here in the country were donating to all sorts of tsunami causes. And, I mean, it was really a groundswell of support from the rest of the world. Did you see that reflected in the people that you dealt with there, or were they too caught up in dealing with the crisis?
Well, I think most of them were just trying to survive. You know, when you you've lost all of your family members. And, you know, I would come in on U.S. Navy helicopters with the fresh water supplies and some food supplies, and people would just swarm the helicopters. You know, they're trying to get whatever they could in these remote areas just to feed themselves that night. And in a lot of cases, it was a mess. They would get rice, but there wouldn't be any cooking oil to cook the rice with. And in some cases, there were fresh water, but there weren't vessels to actually carry it back. And, you know, all kinds of problems that way. But I think, you know, the whole world responded, and the U.S. rightly so as well. Americans were very involved in that, and very generously so. But it is our responsibility in so many ways, you know, as one of the wealthiest nations on the planet, and with the amount of resources to be able to direct that in times of assistance. I think that we even felt some of that generosity returned to us during Katrina. I mean, surprisingly, there were offers of assistance from countries like Uganda that you would never expect. That would want to help out, but they were looking at what was happening here and saying, well, you know, maybe we should help out.
I'm curious, from a media angle, whenever a big story breaks, the networks like to try to send their big anchors in. You know, NBC is going to send Brian Williams to the scene of Katrina or any other disaster to be there and do live reporting from the scene. Not so much with war, because it's much more dangerous, but particularly after a disaster, they like to have the face of the network news team show up there. What does that do to a guy like you who's just a freelancer and at the bottom of the network news ladder?
Yeah, I'm not even sure I'm on the ladder. I'm kind of the dirt around the ladder. But, my whole career has been, you know, being this kind of faceless producer for a long time, working with other correspondents and just by accident getting on the air because I happen to be there with the camera.
Yeah.
And things change from there. I have a lot of respect, you know, for the anchors out there. I've worked with Brian Williams many times. He is someone that's embraced this new technology, likes what I do. I had a whole lot of respect for Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, and I think these people were all reporters first. And so I have no problem. The network invests a lot of money establishing them as a news brand, and they have to be there. It doesn't really displace me because I'm always on the edges of this, you know, these stories anyway. And with the Hot Zone project, in covering all of these conflicts, 20 wars within 1 year, the idea for me was not to cover the headlines, but the people in front of and behind the stories. Not presidents and prime ministers, but the victims, the combatants, everybody in between that never gets interviewed, that never gets their stories told. You know, for instance, Paul, in the Congo, one of the things that we don't realize is that 4 million people have died in this conflict in the Congo. It was considered at one time in the early 90s Africa's first world war because so many different African nations were involved in it. Most of it was a scramble for resources, gold and diamond and coltan, all within eastern Congo. But rape as a weapon of war has become incredibly prevalent there. In fact, 4,500 cases of rape in just 7 months in two provinces in eastern Bukavu. And it's a horrible story, but one that these women that are suffering have been willing to share. And I was just happy to be there to tell that story. And now, I think some mainstream media is picking up on it. New York Times just did a full takeout piece on it. And it's starting to get attention. But, that's why I was there to tell those kind of stories.
Kevin Seitz's book is called In the Hot Zone, One Man, 1 Year, 20 Wars. If you buy it through the KMOX bookstore on KMOX.com, a portion of the proceeds will go to St. Louis Children's Hospital. And you're also donating a portion of your royalties to charity, right?
I had three organizations that I feel very close to, the International Rescue Committee, Save the Children, and CIVIC, the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict. IRC and Save the Children helped me very much on this trip in getting me around to different locations and helping me find stories. But CIVIC is a more interesting story just in the sense that its founder, Marla Rizika, was killed by a suicide bomber in Iraq. She was a friend of mine and a friend of a lot of journalists over there. But most importantly, a friend of the victims of conflict. And what she did was try to get money for people that were killed inadvertently, collateral damage, bombs that drop on the wrong house or people caught in the crossfire. And she would work with the U.S. military and the U.S. government and local government organizations, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, to get them assistance, to get them money to as condolence payments. And she left an amazing legacy of aid for these people, and the work in her name continues. continues in her organization, and you can find that at civic.org, civic.org.
So there'll be a lot of people helped out when you buy a copy of this book and get some of the great stories from Kevin Seitz, and we'll continue with more of those in a moment here as the Paul Harris Show continues on News Talk 1120 KMOX. I'm Paul Harris, talking with reporter Kevin Seitz, whose book is called In the Hot Zone, One Man, One Year, 20 Wars. He spent 368 days away from home, traveled on 71 airplanes to 30 countries, covered 21 conflicts, took 1,320 still photos that he posted online, wrote 153 text stories, and 131 video stories. That's a pretty busy year. And in the book, he says, one of the reasons I wanted to do the Hot Zone project was to help educate the American public about places they barely knew existed. My expectations were unrealistic, but when it ended and there was no miraculous wellspring of newly aware Americans, I felt defeated, then angry. It has yet to subside. Why not? What do you mean?
Well, I think in some ways that we live in a time period when we have access to more information than any other civilization in history. And yet we, within this country in America, live in a poverty of knowledge about the rest of the world, Paul. I mean, you know, quite honestly, we're more interested in Lindsay Lohan getting arrested for drunk driving and Britney Spears shaving her head. And it's unfortunate because if we were a small little country that were insignificant in the world, that would be okay, but we're not. We're the last remaining superpower. We're involved in all of these countries, either economically, politically, or militarily. And so we have to be aware. And, you know, unfortunately, if the citizens of a democracy are not aware of what's going on, they can't have their voice heard in an effective way.
Now, wait a second. I got to ask you a question. Now, are you saying this is on us, or is it on the gatekeepers of American news? And I don't mean a station like KMOX, which doesn't have the resources to do international coverage, but you worked for NBC, which owns a 24-hour news network, MSNBC, and yet does the same kind of stories that you were just talking about over and over and over again, rather than telling us the stories that you're talking about that you think we need to hear. Did you ever take this up with them, and what was their response?
Well, yeah, we're both complicit in this, and I think any journalist that's ever worked for a mainstream news organization has had those arguments. You know, I still have those arguments here at Yahoo News. You know, anyone that is getting their news paid for by advertisers, obviously, unfortunately, has to subscribe to that to some extent, and you know, it's a difficult process. But yes, we are both complicit in that. You know, both the news organizations, but also us as viewers, because in a lot of ways, it's a market demand. You know, people want to see that entertainment news, and they're asking for it, and they prove it by the ratings. I know in one specific case with CNN that they had an interview with Condoleezza Rice, and on the Fox News Channel, they had an interview with Anna Nicole Smith's lawyer or something about some breaking development there. And the situation was that when that happened, the ratings for Fox and the Anna Nicole Smith story were sky high compared to the Condoleezza Rice interview. And, you know, part of that is, yes, consumer demand, but part of it is, how are we telling these stories? Are we not getting to the human side of them? Are we not making them interesting enough to actually get attention? Because I think there's a lot of inherent drama in what's happening in the world. I think it's fascinating, but, you know, we need to tell the story a little bit better, and viewers have to be more aggressive. If they don't like the news that they're getting from certain outlets, we have access to everything. You can go to the BBC now. You can read newspapers, Arabic newspapers that are translated into English language versions on the internet. You can get all of this access to this information on the internet, and you don't even have to search for it that hard. You can set your web browser to have it brought to your inbox. So, you know, we're all responsible to some extent, but our knowledge really is, you know, it's a sad thing to behold. We just really don't know what's going on in the world.
You know, there was a TV show called Max Headroom several years ago, and the main character, before being turned into the Max Headroom character, was a guy who traveled around covering stories, and it was just him and a camera. And he was able to go places, and it was in the pre-wireless age, it was in the pre-internet age, it was in the pre-satellite TV age. You're Max Headroom. You go out there with, you can now do it with a digital handheld video camcorder and be that one-man band who goes out there and covers those. You don't have to turn into the stuttering animated character that is Max Headroom. But you're that other guy, and you're the future. Are there
sometimes
others?
Sometimes the stuttering just comes with it, Paul. I can't help that.
I think are many others who have followed in your footsteps, and you are certainly one of those who blazed that trail of telling stories from those areas. And if the networks don't want to put it on, there's a whole world wide web that makes your information available to a lot of people who are interested in that, and all they got to do is search it and find it. And I'm sure your friends at Yahoo would like people to use yahoo.com to find that, or to go to your website hotzone.yahoo.com, or Kevin's own website, which is kevinsightsreports.com. The book is called In the Hot Zone: 1 Man, 1 Year, 20 Wars. Use the link on kmox.com, and a portion of the proceeds will go to help out St. Louis Children's Hospital. It's a pleasure talking to you. Good luck with all of your travels.
Paul, thanks so much.
Hope we get a chance to do it again. Kevin Seitz here on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX.